All lines are now bridged.
Good morning, everyone. Welcome to what is now the second meeting of the Information Blocking Full Task Force. We have a lot to discuss, so I won't waste time. I will jump right in, just starting with a brief roll call. Andy Trescott?
Present.
Michael Adcock?
Here.
Stephen Lane?
Good morning.
Good morning. Cheryl Turney? Denise Webb?
Present.
Sasha Termont?
Here.
Erin Meary?
Good morning.
Arian Malik?
Good morning.
Valerie Gray?
Here.
Anil Jain?
Here.
Great. Cynthia Fisher?
Good morning.
John Kansky? Lauren Thompson? I believe she's going to be absent today. And Denny McComb?
Present.
Perfect. And with that, I'm going to turn it over to Michael Adcock, who's going to get us started today with a review of the progress of Work Group 1.
Well, good morning, everyone. Happy to be here on a Friday. Thankfully, it's Friday. We've had a very busy week of work group calls. I know you're all aware, since most of you have been on at least one, if not two, so far this week. So first, I just wanted to thank you on behalf of myself and Andy for all of the hard work. I know that there's been a lot of time taken out, not just in the work group meetings, but also in the pre-work before and reviewing and coming up with great comments. So wanted to thank you all for that and for all the hard work that goes on and that will continue to go on as we move forward. You can see the agenda on this page. We have a full agenda. The first three are going to be overviews. We're going to walk through the overviews of the different work groups. These are for informational purposes, just so you can see what the work groups have been working on. For those of you that are in different work groups, I want you to just have a flavor of what we're going through. And then when we finish work group three's overview, we're going to go into, Andy's going to lead us into some discussion around some of the, as we call them, big rocks, some of the issues that we need to review and discuss as an overall task force. Andy will lead us through that discussion, just trying to get some idea of some of the bigger things that we need to work out and get some comment from those, especially comments from people who are in other work groups. So if we have an issue that we're working through in group one, we'd love to hear what group two and three have to think about that, or individuals from group two and three, primarily just so we can hear those perspectives. As we discussed originally, there's going to be a lot of work going on in the different work groups, but we want to have time in the overall task force to hear people's opinions that have those on the individual bigger issues. So we'll jump right into the overview of work group one. Next slide, please. So you can see here, we'll go right through these. You'll see these. Here's the agenda. Here's the meeting dates. You're already into these, so you know what this looks like. Next slide, please. So work group one. These are some of the items that we talked about. And again, this is for informational purposes, just so you can know what we're working through. As we talk about health information networks and exchanges, and Andy can chip in here anytime he'd like, we're going to talk through the scope of definitions. You know, are these definitions too narrow? We looked at whether they're too narrow, whether they're too broad. Is there potential for gaming? We looked at situations when a provider is also a health information network or health information exchange. That was some discussion that came up. We looked at the penalties, what those penalties should be. Are they too harsh? Are they not harsh enough? The intent of definitions to cover external interfaces from a hospital. So one of the big discussions that we had in work group one over the last couple of meetings was around the intent of the definitions. You know, because the rules are meant to cover a wide range of different actors, you know, what's the intent around those definitions as we're looking at whether it's the interface from a hospital to a hospital or something along those lines. EHI definition, should this definition be augmented to include clarity around actors? The human readable or codified information, should we exclude aggregated patient information? So lots of discussions around these different topics. Next slide, please. This was a big one, and this is one that Andy will talk about when we get to the discussion point of this. Pricing information. There's a couple of views that we had on that. One view is that we need price transparency, and now's the time to address it within the context of information blocking. There are no other levels to address it available, so this might be the perfect opportunity to discuss it and to address it. Andy will bring that up again after we go through the overviews. And there's also a view that price transparency is important, but out of scope for this rule. Unintended consequences also need to be considered. And we had a long discussion about unintended consequences of including price transparency or addressing price transparency as a part of this rule and a part of this work group. So there'll be discussion around that after overview of group three. Practices that may implicate the information blocking provision. We had some discussion regarding the scope and implications of examples of potential information blocking. There was good discussion around that. And then we also looked at parties affected by the information blocking provision and exceptions. Definition of scope and scope of actor, obviously a lot of discussion around that. What the payer role is, what the definition of payers are, concern regarding self-insured companies and where they fall in this process as well. Next slide. So as you can see, a lot of information going on in work group one. Andy will lead us through work group two now.
Thanks, Mike. Go to the next slide, please. Okay, so the topics that we've been discussing in work group two. First up, preventing harm. There's an overarching concern around many of the exceptions that they could become large holes that give organizations an opportunity to exempt themselves from information blocking obligations. So there is a need to tighten these as much as possible to make them as prescriptive as possible and as narrow as possible. In A1 around preventing harm, rather than just looking at inaccuracy, the comment is made that everybody's health record has some level of inaccuracy inside it, but the suggestion is that we actually talk about being true data corruption, so technology-based data corruption where the data has been messed up somehow, so by the technology itself. A2, as you can see here, why would a provider correct a mistake if there's no obligation to do so? So we're discussing about where a provider should be told to make a correction. Correct the deficiency that's in the record. A3, we're talking about whether this is actually aimed specifically at certain mental health conditions. We're working through where there's an individualized finding, how that should actually be recorded inside the record itself, and whether that would also be counted as EHI. And we're picking up some semantics around use of the word relevant versus the word appropriate. And we're just making sure that there's appropriate usage in the relevant paragraphs of those terms. Next slide, please. And secondly, in work group, we're looking at the topic around promoting the privacy of EHI itself. So we've been working through how the language could be added. The organizational policies must be lawful even of themselves. Just because you have a policy that says you won't share, that doesn't mean that policy is valid or legal, and capturing how to include that. Again, we have around recording where consent or dissent has been expressed by a patient. It's not simply enough potentially to say, oh, they must have consented and we won't. Again, semantics around the use of meaningful and what that actually means. Again, this is another one of those overarching topics that's come through every work group around some of the semantics, making sure that words are understood and not too subjective and allow too much wiggle room. Next slide, please. Okay, Mike, back to you.
Very good. Again, here's the agenda and the cadence of meetings. Next slide, please. So group three, one of the things that we discussed a lot of was assurances, looking at the ambiguity and full compliance and unrestricted implementation language in the preamble. So we spent a lot of time going back and forth between the preamble and the regulatory text. Again, lots of discussion around intent. We talk a lot about intent. What's the intent of, what's the scope of retention in under Area B1, comparison of time periods for record retention and records access. proposal of 3-year retention period for voluntary withdrawals, and proposal for infinite retention period. So we had discussion around what the period should be. Self-developers was a topic that we covered as well. Next slide, please. Under assurances, the request for information on participation in the TEFCA, cannot comment without seeing TEFCA. So we need to see that without before we can make comments on that. Communications, we spent a lot of time talking about intellectual property issues, how to protect developer community from nefarious purposes. There's a lot of discussion about fair use, and we need to make sure we fully understand the intent of and the definition of fair use and how it pertains and how it we're allowing fair use but still protecting IP. Looked at whistleblower protection, looked at notification to vendors and what that looked like because there was some language in the rule that was may have been a little bit difficult to operationalize. So we're looking at that notification period to vendors and third-party vendors. The scope of non-user facing, so we looked at the proposed amendment was to adjust definitions to clarify that administrative functions of HIT would be not user-facing aspects. There are a lot of administrative functions that go on within HIT that don't really impact the user, so should be non-user-facing. And based on the assessment that those communications are not matching the purpose described in 21st Century Cures, and it's also a limited set of users, so we're not talking about, you know, even the large list of providers. We're talking about a very limited set of users in that. So that was our proposed amendment. Next slide, please. Screenshots, we spent a long time talking about screenshots and whether or not layouts are and should be considered IP. We know that there's varying opinions on that, so we had discussions around that. Purpose of prioritizing communication between healthcare entities. Comparing configuration between healthcare entities should pose minimal risk to IP rights. So as we're working within health systems or health entities to try to make sure that workflows are moving in the best way possible, a lot of times it's very helpful to be able to share and between those healthcare entities without posing risk to IP rights. Possible proposal would be to draw a distinction around purpose of use. I think also in relation to fair use definition, fair use might be applicable or insufficient, just depending on how that is defined and how we use that definition. The discussion of D2, 3 and 4 would be possible proposal should be amended to a list of which third-party content might appear in a screen. Enumerating elements per screen is not feasible. There could be a great deal of third-party content, and being able to operationalize that could be extremely difficult. Extensive conversation about the complexity and possibility of doing this. Again, this was around being able to operationalize some of the third-party content, I mean. Discussion of E, possible proposal for the section E would be an effort for notice and contracting is only 40 hours. It's massively underestimated. We recommend that the ONC should revise estimate. More roles involved than just a clerk. Work involved on the part of recipients. Eliminate the 2-year time frame and propose an updated next renewal. There was some discussion around changing the contracts and amending contracts, and we know that would be extremely burdensome and are looking at whether you eliminate that 2-year time frame for that and propose an update at the next renewal. So it would go into effect for those new contracts immediately, but allow for a renewal period since we know that some of the contracts that vendors have are 5 years, 10 years. So we need to just look at that as well. Next slide, please. Discussion of B2. Again, that's where we were talking about the contract renewal. State a roadmap within 2 years with compliance not to be unreasonable. So we're again, looking at ways to make sure that this is not overly burdensome, does not create a huge change in or a huge unintended consequence in changing those proposals. Enforcement, as we were looking at through the enforcement pieces of this, there is a ban that is very serious but fair given the process proposed by ONC. ONC has a process concerning enforcement that has been very well thought out. It's actually not originally a part of this rule. It was a rule from 2016, but it's a great chart and graph as to how the process is proposed by the ONC. A possible proposal would be to use both email and certified mail for notices initiating direct review, potential nonconformity, nonconformity, suspension, proposed termination, and termination. So again, there is one of the pieces of the enforcement is a ban, and we want to make sure that there are clear steps as to what stage a vendor is in before we get to the overall ban. So there was a lot of discussion around that. The process is great, but we want to make sure that the ban is the final step unless it's some type of nefarious act. Next slide, please. And now Andy will talk about, again, the overarching charge, but more importantly, talk about some of these discussion areas that have come up in the different task force groups, the larger, again, the larger ones that consumed more of the comment period so that we can get some input from others. Andy?
Thanks, Mike. Just before I do that, I want to open up to any of the members of the work group, so the task force members. Is there any burning issues that you'd like to raise that have come out of this first week of work that you think, you know, we could usefully discuss or share with the broader group?
And it may be one of the burning issues, but it relates to the definition of health information networks. So if we've got a session on that, I'll hold.
I wasn't going to touch upon HIN in this morning's call, so go for it.
Yeah, so the breadth of the definition of EHI and of HIN places a large number of entities into the scope of information blocking rules, in particular into the scope of the information blocking exceptions and pricing rules. And I'm not sure that anybody's looked at the what possibly would be unintended consequences of that, nor I think have people looked at the intent of Congress relative to information blocking. So my read of the combination of electronic health information and the definition of health information network would place functions like a billing service, a clearinghouse, electronic records retention, a whole set of activities under information blocking and associated pricing restrictions. And it's not clear to me that Congress intended that the scope of information blocking be extended to those entities. So I just wondered whether the work group had looked at the potential broad scope of the definition of health information, not health information network. So as an example, banking services could be considered electronic health information. It's information related to payment. It contains an identifier that ties back to a claiming or remittance ID. And it's going from a payer to a bank to a provider. So that falls under the definition of electronic health information and under the definition of health information network. So are banking services considered to fall under information blocking provisions and associated price transparency provisions? Anyway, that's the nature of the comment and request for the work group to take up that particular item, because I don't know that anybody's thought through all of the consequences of the two definitions.
Thanks, Harry, and that's very useful, and thanks for the input there. To help reassure you, yes, the group has already had extensive conversation around the definitions of EHI, HIN, and also HIE. You know, the definition of HIE within the current drafting is fairly broad and could, you know, in some interpretations be used to apply to, you know, pretty much anybody out there, every provider, mm-hmm. no matter where they sit. So that is being discussed. And actually, you know, I was premature when I said that I didn't intend HIN to be one of the big rocks to discuss, but actually where you went, it is one of the big rocks. It's the scope of encompassment of the current drafting of the rule. There's been lots of feedback across all the work groups that it's very broad. Okay, so that the actual breadth of the actors that could be included.
Just as a request to include maybe some of the use cases or some of the consequences that I drew out, like, you know, are banking and payment services associated with claiming and reimbursement, and remittance should they be part of the scope of information blocking and associated provisions? Should clearinghouses fall within that scope? Should billing services or billing services fall within that scope? So maybe just some examples to sharpen people's minds in terms of what the potential scope of the those definitions might be.
Absolutely, and we are going to do that. Well, I also would like to solicit your input to that because I'm pretty sure you've got some of this stuff already scribed in your thoughts. There's an interesting chicken and egg scenario here as well, which ties into another one of the big rocks I'd like to discuss around the price transparency that Mike was mentioning earlier. And that sort of ties into lots of the billing services too. Well, if price becomes an element of EHI, then, you know, it makes sense that a billing service becomes an actor who's actually implicated as for information blocking purposes. I'd like to kind of come back to price transparency, but I'd like a bit more of a discussion across the entire task force about what our beliefs are around the intent of 21st century cures and the breadth of actors within the healthcare ecosystem that we believe should be touched by these rules. Open floor. Okay, I'm going to ask Arian specifically. Arian, do you think that that breadth that you articulated is the original intent that the Act was drawn around?
I do not believe that the breadth that I articulated was the intent of Congress. I think if you look at the deliberation of Congress and the thrust of the 21st Century Cures Act, that the intent of Congress was to address potential rent-seeking behavior by EHRs, as well as provider organizations that refuse to make information flow. I don't know that Congress thought through or intended to make these provisions apply to market-based services that were already in full flight and working quite well.
Okay, so you think that would be an unintended consequence, which would be an unfortunate unintended consequence as opposed to a fortunate one?
Yes.
Okay. And is that the consensus across the group? Oh, John Kansky has raised his hand. John.
So, Andy, sorry for this will be some reruns from our discussion on the work group meetings, but just echoing my version of, I think, Arian's perspective is that I just think that good policy is as precise and focused as it can be, being a blunt instrument to begin with. So we want to understand Congress's intent, but we need to make this as clear as possible, one, to achieve the desired end, but also, two, to minimize the confusion and cost of complying with the regulation, and I dare say, three, minimizing the industry pushback if it's too broad. So I feel like I don't yet have a grasp on what the unintended consequences might be, and I think we need to think about that. But regardless, precision and as narrow as possible, but no narrower, is best.
Thanks, John. Actually, Arian, if I put you on the spot again, because you've obviously been thinking this through, you know, the unintended consequences are certainly from the angle you were coming on around billing and market-ready services, et cetera. Could you possibly just talk through those a moment?
Sure. This is gonna overlap with some stuff that we haven't gotten to in the information blocking exceptions. Yeah, but you know, if you look at what's required to comply with the pricing provisions in particular, as well as some of the provisions of information blocking, the net is that a whole range of services that are currently available and working well for provider organizations and for payer-based organizations are going to have to be rethought and repriced in ways that I don't think anybody's really intended in drafting the regulation, or certainly was the intent of Congress. So, for example, my belief, and again, I think we need to get through this in the exceptions work group, is that as we think through the accounting rules and legal and compliance rules associated with pricing out services to comply with 171, 204, and 206, that what we're going to end up with is raising the price for basic commodity services that serve that already serve industry well. So, you know, the price of a claim will go up, the price of a remit will go up, the price of banking services for healthcare will go up because there'll be additional compliance burdens associated with those. Without, you know, and those can be fine, but without actually any information blocking concern currently in market. So we won't be addressing any significant market failure, but we will be putting substantial burden on top of organizations that are already working in practice.
Okay, thanks, Aaron. That's helpful. So
yep.
one of the viewpoints that we have heard through another one of the work groups is certainly that there is a failure in the market for the benefit of patients to provide adequate transparency to pricing. And if you look at some of the drafting inside the current rule, where you know there is a request for insights which could help lead towards price transparency, wouldn't that be an argument where actually we should be extending information blocking to include those kinds of entities?
In general, it's the provider organization that is the so if you think about where pricing comes from, pricing ultimately comes from the payer through a remit. But many of the interesting issues in pricing are coming from providers in terms of charge master, in terms of the amount of claim, and in particular with respect to out-of-network billing. And in many of those cases, it really is the provider that's the ultimate source for pricing information, as opposed to the intermediaries. But you know, I can definitely accept the point that intermediary access to pricing data could be a good relative to you know, opening that up. I still think the other issues associated with putting those services under information blocking provisions will just lead to a net increase in healthcare costs. So it's one where there's a reasonable policy outcome, but the currently chosen tool is a pretty blunt instrument.
Yeah, to John's point, my policy is by necessity blunt because it touches everybody equally. Is someone else trying to interject there?
Yeah, that was Stephen. I just wanted to add that when you talk about the provider being the source of the pricing, I think we have to remember that we're talking about clinicians, we're talking about labs, we're talking about imaging centers, we're talking about pharmacies. The provider is, as you use the term, is all of those.
Yes, I'm of course referring to USC 300JJ in my use of the term healthcare provider. Of course.
Yeah, and I think price transparency isn't necessarily just what you were describing there, Arian. You know, that there is a large ecosystem around the entire revenue cycle that has price and cost, and transparency into that isn't just necessarily a provider thing, but also an element of the payer as well. Would you concur? Arian?
Sorry, I wasn't thinking of that question as directed to me. sorry, could you repeat it?
It was a statement that I then asked whether you concurred or not. It sounds like you weren't listening to me. But yeah, do you?
Was I listening? No, I was not listening.
Okay, Arian, I'll bear that in mind for future use. Okay,
sorry.
All I was saying was that it's not as clear-cut, I think, as saying it's a provider issue here. We're talking about broader transparency across the health continuum, both in cost and price.
Right. So again, I go back to my point that there could be some policy goods for expanding access and speaking. And again, putting on my Change Healthcare hat. There's some industry interest here because we run a clearinghouse, we run payment services. I think we generally would prefer to open up more access for information. And would prefer, if permitted, to open up access for pricing information. We've got a strong interest in offering access to consumers for self-payment tools. The obstacles in practice are generally not the obstacles that information blocking aims at, although there is an unintended consequence that where the information blocking provisions could help. Most of the issues involved in data liquidity at the clearinghouse or payment network sides are come in play because of BAA contractual restrictions. It's usually the payer or provider who has restricted data use at a BAA level in ways that make it harder for information to flow to patients.
Okay, thanks, Alan. So one of the questions we have been asked is whether price should be considered EHI. Now, if I look upon your opening statements around the original intent of Congress, or your belief, your understanding of the original intent of Congress for the Act, being more focused around the exchange of clinical information for the purposes of clinical care, I'm paraphrasing you, but I think that's where you were going.
Yeah, that's right.
Oh, you're listening.
Yeah, so I'm definitely listening to you. I apologize. So I would generally agree, number one, that so first of all, I have an interest, and I think a number of organizations have an interest in increased pricing transparency and increased access to patients for self-billing tools and payment tools and other areas that help them drive transparency and flexible decision making. At the same time, I think if Congress had intended 21st century cures to address these issues, then Congress would have written things like price transparency into the legislative text. If that's the justification for driving these things in, I do think there's clearly a policy interest, and I'm rambling a little bit, but I think we need to minimize or find more finely tune the policy interest to the consequences of information blocking regulation, and I don't know that right now the rules strike the right balance. I know the rules right now don't strike the right balance.
Okay, so the Act doesn't say that information blocking, the information inside information blocking is solely clinical.
I have to go back and reread the Act.
That's why we're trying to go through the definition of EHI right now.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, this is Cynthia. I'm just, I think we had a long discussion about this yesterday, but on our committee, but I think what's really important is that we look at the definition and you look at the HIPAA definition of portability and how important access that the patient, the intention of CURES was to empower the patient to have access to their information. And that information is, it looking at that original health information from 1996, is both the physical and mental health information and the condition of the patient, past, present, and future. And the second part of that definition is the payment information, past, present, and future payment. So just like grocery or any other industry, and forgive my members of Committee 1, but have hearing this twice, is that we need a functional, free, and competitive marketplace. And that was the intention of the law. That was the intention of CURES, is to cease and desist on the anti-competitive processes that don't empower the patient with decisions. And, everywhere you go today, if someone can choose to get their MRI or their breast imaging with their high deductible at a much lower out-of-pocket cost and a much lower cost to their employer and their self-insured employer. It puts money back into the pocket of the consumer and lets them drive their health decisions and their wealth decisions. So if you look at the whole, the intention was to have for competition, because only in competition can we drive down, improve our quality and move toward excellence and drive down the cost of care.
I think we agree with the goal. It's not clear to me that, or it is clear to me that the tools that are being applied are rather blunt to achieve the goal, and will do so actually in ways that probably will reduce data liquidity because they'll just increase the cost of services. So this is really about making sure that we open up the data without using a hammer to open up a faucet.
Well, I disagree with that. You know, back in 92, I started a healthcare company that would accept insurance and cash, and we could do it at a tenth the price. And people paid, and they paid out of choice, and they could evaluate quality, and they could evaluate the service and price. So I think if we look across the spectrum, we could see what people are willing to accept, both in cash, both in payment from coverage, and
You're maybe misunderstanding my point. Yeah.
You'll be able to have think about what we have as this opportunity and moment of time. And I am so excited to be on this committee with you all because this is transformative. I mean, what we can do collectively as an organization and our efforts here is to plow that runway of the opacity that exists in today's system of the high mountains and the piles of opacity on the runway and clear it for a technological revolution. You know, I think Don Rucker, when he kicked off the first ONC high tech meeting, spoke about how Yelp and Uber and Amazon and the rest of the tech world works so well to drive down. Look at Uber on the cost of going to the airport versus a taxi. Uber didn't wait till the medallion in the taxi cab set standards on how their pricing would be posted. So I think have this incredible, I'm an entrepreneur, so I look at this incredible opportunity for us to deliver to the healthcare marketplace options and choices and knowledge. It's so cool.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure you wouldn't start a company in an environment where your prices were restricted. Your ability to define value-based pricing was restricted, and where the compliance needs associated with pricing placed an additional burden on your accounting systems and your legal and compliance systems. So I first of all, I completely agree with the point on the generative value placed on transparency and increased data liquidity, and that's clearly been the goal of a good chunk of my career and the work that I've done in the U.S. healthcare sector. It is the overlap of the price regulation in the information blocking exceptions with the broad definition that causes me concern. And I think if we found an approach for price regulation that was targeted at rent-seeking behavior, but not targeted at market-based services, I think we'd find a place where we drive the innovation that you're looking for. My basic concern right now is based on the broad definition and particularly many of the pricing regulations that are in cures. What we'll end up doing is actually impeding innovation because the Ubers and Lyfts of the world aren't going to start up their services if they're under, price controls.
Well, therein we can agree to disagree, because if we don't provide a framework and follow what we've been asked to do, then are we not information blocking ourselves from progress to do so? And I don't know of any industry where I would want to go buy something as a consumer or partake in something or manage something so critical such as my health, with having absolutely no knowledge and having to show up with a blank check at whatever some entity wants to pay. So,
yeah,
you know,
Arian,
we're seeing people suffer
definitely.
From $101,000 out-of-network surgery bills and facility fees and being sued by their own hospitals with days in court over fragments of medical bills with court fees on each segment of a bill. I mean, it's out of control, and we have the opportunity. We are being asked to do this by HHS, and I think it's our job to find a way how rather than to come up with the blocking reasons of why not. And to protect status quo. Status quo is broken. And this is the time. We are in the moment of time to deliver.
It's quite possible you
okay.
understand my point, but I suspect it's going to be an ongoing point of conversation for this group.
And this is why we're raising it. Now, John raised his hand, and then Aaron. So, John Gansky.
Yeah, just quickly listening to the back and forth, I think this is about balancing our responsibility to have a regulation that moves us toward the desire for health data transparency and pricing transparency, balancing that with having a regulation that is implementable, enforceable, and at a reasonable cost.
Thanks, John. Good points. Aaron, maybe.
Yep. Hello, Aaron. I agree with John, and I want to expand upon that a little bit more. I think there are two dimensions of this. One, the information blocking from a clinical diagnoses, results, images, all of that. That not being shared. I mean, I'll only give you a couple of real world stories here very quickly on that dimension, which is I'm acutely aware of a couple of metropolitan areas with hospitals that are only a couple miles apart that refuse to share, excluding any treatment purposes, you know, type data unless they are indigent care. They won't share commercial payer information at all, again, unless it's treatment purposes at the point of care, because they're worried about losing referral patterns. Other issues like that occur in magnitude, and that's what we're here to solve, is those types of issues. On the pricing comment, I think it is our charge to look at how can we better incentivize and make sure that information is disseminated out there. Generally speaking, healthcare institutions are reluctant to share those prices as it relates to the charge master and what the negotiated rates are with the payers for whatever reason. And again, to the comment that was made earlier about patient suffering, that does happen because people have those surprise medical bills that now you're seeing bills go through various state legislators trying to eliminate that. So I think on both those dimensions, it's up to us as a committee to address them, be upfront with them, be transparent, and say this type of behavior has to stop. But I also do agree with Arian's comment that we don't want to try to boil the ocean, but we should be specific in how we go about this so that we don't have the unintended consequences of HIE organizations trying to solve the price transparency issue and otherwise. It needs to be very defined and very pragmatic, but we do need to call attention to this practice.
Thank you, Aaron. That's helpful. That's sort of helpful spotlight on some of this as well. Has anybody else got any comments in this particular area? We've moved into the price transparency discourse.
So this is Denny. I made it clear, I think, in the work group that I feel like price transparency is outside of the scope of this regulation. But I wonder if it'd be helpful if ONC could maybe bring to our work group and maybe the full task force what's already going on with price transparency and what's already proposed in other parts of the federal government. Since, like, as hospitals, we were already required to publish our pricing as of January 1st of this year. Are we treading someplace that we're overlapping something that's already going on?
That's good. Mark, can you just provide a written update that we can put to each of the work groups? That would be useful.
I can work on that. Are we talking about for each work group or just the one specifically
just a one half page of it. It just describes what else is going on, and we'll just make sure every work group has it so that every member of the task force has it.
Yeah.
The other thing, Mark, that would be helpful is anything in the CARES Act that relates to price transparency, if there is something there that could be interpreted that way, it'd be helpful to see what that is.
Sure, and I can definitely do that. I would just direct everyone to read the definitions in the rule and to read cures, like, you know, the definite, how they how it's described information blocking and the actors, because it's important for the scope of this conversation to understand those definitions really well.
Thank you, Matt.
Including
you'll be joining us.
Yep.
And
yep.
I think this is Cynthia. I just want to make sure that we all keep in perspective from the patient's point of view. You know, if we're representing a provider or you're representing an insurer, that you just remember the patient. I think if you put the patient in the focal point, so, you know, you look at a colonoscopy, somebody's 50, they're well, they're just told they need it by their primary care, it's time, you're tick-tock, you're on the clock, it'll be covered. But no one knows, okay, what hospital system do I go to where what will my out-of-pocket be? What will my insurer pay? So they don't have any optics to know that. We even have physicians saying they don't even know themselves that they just found out that their own pathologist and the radiologist and the anesthesiologist are all out of network and don't even know it. And all of a sudden you have a surprise $6,000 bill that it was no reference based billing, no references to be able to see is that reasonable, not reasonable, and no. You could have gotten it elsewhere where everybody was in network and only had a small copay. So, you know, $6,000 difference is real money to most citizens in this country. And I think we just have to remember that we are in this moment of time where HHS has done a beautiful job to help. Basically, we're there to help to be able to change the game in healthcare so that we're not devastating the wallets and the financial future of families and patients. So I think we all should call to our inner responsibility and fiduciary to our citizenry.
And Andy, can I jump in? I just want to make one point real quickly. I know we need to get to the public comment, that just to clarify what is in our regulation as far as pricing. We have a request for information, and what we're trying to do is better understand how to address pricing information in a standardized way and how to define pricing information in the context of information blocking. So I just want to emphasize that right now it's a request for information that's in there, specifically related to price transparency. That's all I want.
Yeah, actually, Mark, to be clear, there is, as you described, but there's also a question about whether price should be included in the definition of EHI.
Yeah, I believe that you're referencing the request for information still, though, right?
Yeah, it's two parts to that. Yep, cool. Okay, given we have 3 minutes before we have to go to public comment, can we go, Lauren, can we go to public comment now? I believe that...
Yeah, we're actually right on time for public comment.
Okay, great. So I believe there is actually some public questions already appearing in the chat box. So if you could possibly repeat them in the period of public comment, I'd much appreciate that. Thank you.
Great. Operator, can we please open the line?
Certainly. If you'd like to make a public comment, please press star 1 on your telephone keypad. A confirmation tone will indicate your line is in the queue, and you may press star 2 if you'd like to remove your comment from the queue. For participants using speaker equipment, it may be necessary to pick up your handset before pressing the star keys.
Thank you. We've had the number up for a few minutes, so hopefully that has given folks time to dial in. Operator, do we have any comments in the queue at this time?
Not at this time.
Okay, so that leaves us with just about 9 minutes or so. We'll leave the phone number up just for another minute or so, but Andy, in the meantime, I'll hand it back to you.
Thanks, Lauren. Okay, so there was a question that came through into the public chat box saying from an individual called Mark, won't information blocking the content apply to the stuff covered in the USCDI only? Mark Nee, you can secondary comment on this. My understanding right now is no, it's as per the definition that Ariane Malek has helpfully posted into the public chat box as well with the existing proposed definition of electronic health information, that is actually the definition that would apply to information blocking, not purely the USCDI conceptualization. Mark?
Right, yeah. So I would encourage folks, definitely we do have a part of the regulation talked about US CDI, but definitely don't want to mix those two up. In the information blocking context, we'd be looking at EHI, the definition that we provide. You'd be looking at whether you're an actor as defined in CURES that would be covered by the information blocking provision. You'd look at whether there's an interference with access, exchange, or use, whether there's the requisite knowledge by the actor, and whether the practice is required by law or covered by an exception. So that's kind of the framework for information blocking. US CDI is very important to understand and fits in somewhat, but as far as information blocking goes, we're looking broadly at the EHI definition that we described.
Thanks, Mark. Do we have any questions on the coming through from public?
Operator, any more callers in the queue?
Not at this time.
Okay. Stephen Lane has got his hand raised. Steve.
Yeah, thank you. I think you asked a really key question about whether or not pricing information is electronic health information. And I think that Arian, the text that you shared is very helpful in the last sentence where it says that past, present, or future payment for the provision of health care to an individual is part of the definition. So that seems very clear to me that that would include price, net price, et cetera. Is there a question about that still?
Well, we're being asked whether that definition should include price.
Well, it does, doesn't it, Andy? I mean, we're looking
it
at
does,
it now.
It does right now, but yep, it does.
Yes, and that is the intent of this. You know, if we move it out, then we're information blocking, you know, quite frankly, because healthcare electronic records, at least when I was an IBMer many decades ago, were shared electronically first in billing and payment information before we got to the digitization of the clinical. So, I mean, this has been in place for years. So I think this is just saying that that's all inclusive of what's been digitized and able to be shared and portable to the patient as well.
And I'll just say that Cynthia does a great job representing the voice of the consumer. You know, one of my hats here I wear is the voice of the clinician. And I can tell you, having that price information at the point of care would be transformative, as you know, Cynthia has laid out. So I hope that we can include in our comments that keeping that price information in the definition is really in the best interest of patients, providers, and I also believe that was the intent of Congress, and really what we've been hearing from Don since the launch of the high tech.
Thank you very
much. This is
John
Hansky. I just want to.
John
Hansky's
got his hand raised.
Go ahead, sorry.
No, just real quick. So regarding the point that ONC has written into the definition payment, my understanding, which may be right or wrong, is that they somewhat borrowed the definition from HIPAA and are asking us specifically, should payment be in that definition or not? So we're trying to feedback and answer that question. One of the observations I made on the call, the workgroup call yesterday, is that HIPAA, it was a regulation designed to define information that should be protected, and we're now defining information that should be shared. And I don't know that that necessarily answers the question of whether payment should be in or out, but it's worth considering.
Thanks, John. Arian, you were trying to bring
your
hand.
I just want to go on record as saying that I am pro-transparency and actually have been the victim of out-of-network billing. For me, the issue here is what is the unintended consequences of application of other parts of information blocking. I think many people are looking eagerly at the notion that information will start to flow. I may be looking more pessimistically at the pricing regulation in 171, 204, and 206, and seeing a net disincentive for startup and innovation services that actually affect pricing flowing, price information flowing. So to me, this is about getting the policy balance right to make sure that the information that we open with one hand, we don't close with the other.
Thanks, Arian. That's helpful. You know, just so everyone's aware, inside the rule reg drafting right now, there's a request for information, and it's in two parts. The first part is about whether the definition, which we have on screen right now for EHI, should include price information or not. Right now, it has past, present, and future payment. Should that be there or not? And the second is, to what extent could ONC with rules address price transparency? And that's kind of the crux of where we're discussing. John Kansky, you've still got your hand raised. Is that inadvertent? Yep, it's down again. Cool. As operator, are there any public comments?
We have none at this time.
No, thanks very much. Lauren, given that we're coming to the bottom of the hour, it's been a great conversation as far as I'm concerned. Hang on a second. Denise Webb has just raised her hand. Denise.
Yeah, I just wanted to make one comment concerning the discussion around the definition of EHI and what's intended under information blocking relative to the U.S. CDI. If information blocking has that broader definition of EHI, yet there is not the standards and the capability to electronically exchange beyond a set of elements defined in the U.S. CDI, don't those potentially conflict? So if you're not giving, providing through exchange requests for EHI for that broad definition, because your system only provides and is able to exchange what's defined in the U.S. CDI standard, my question is, don't those two conflict? Maybe I'm not understanding that correctly.
Why would they conflict?
So if the definition of electronic health information is broad, it's any electronic health information related to the patient's care, payment, and so forth, I guess what I'm asking, do every one of those elements that are under EHI, does the U.S. CDI provide for exchange of those?
Oh, I get what you're saying. Okay, I think the U.S. CDI is a proper subset of EHI. So the U.S. CDI defines a subset of how to structure and transport information, but it's not all of EHI, if that makes sense. So
yeah,
EHI
so
is a larger sphere.
Okay, so if I'm a provider and I have a certified electronic health record system that can exchange the elements that are in the U.S. CDI, yet I'm requested by a patient to provide all electronic information available on that patient, and I can't give it to them because my system only exchanges is capable. I mean, I guess I could give it to them. It might not be useful. That's what I'm asking. Don't the two conflict? The information blocking?
We'll check this, Mark. We'll check this with Steve Posnack. My understanding right now is they wouldn't conflict because there is a whole wealth of information standards extant here in the US, which US CDI will touch upon and leverage, but won't be includes completely consuming of. So I don't believe that they're in conflict with each other. I think US CDI supports it.
So what you're saying is under the information blocking, if a provider's requested to, has an authorized request to provide all the electronic health information on the patient, some of that might be provided through a standard way, like through the API, FHIR API,
yep.
And the US CDI elements, but the rest of it would have to be provided another way. Is that
potentially, I think so.
Yeah.
But there's a whole wealth of
information
standards.
Blocking.
Correct.
So this is Mark from ONC. I'll definitely look into it more and talk with the folks who focused on the USCAI section. But I don't believe there is a conflict. I believe, you know, CURES is pretty clear about the breadth of information that we should be looking at, and I think it goes to the definition of EHI, not necessarily just the US CDI. Sorry, go ahead.
But Mark, there's a specific part text in the proposed rule that says that at the present time, ONC acknowledges that the Cures Act does say all EHI, all electronic health information, but right now the capability can only focus on a subset of that. So I'm just trying to understand what the expectation is relative to the information blocking.
When I just want to be careful that the US CDI discussion is a bit different. And again, I know we're running out of time, so I'm happy to like follow up on this and talk to Steve or others in ONC to clarify. But I guess I still don't believe there's a conflict. But does someone else want to say something?
No, it's just Denise, we can follow up offline, but we are at time.
Okay.
Duncansky has had his hand raised for a while. John?
Just quickly, I think building on the point that Denise is making, something that came up in our work group call is when thinking about the ability of, for example, a provider to comply with the regulation, if the if they have to share all EHI and some of it's in US CDI that their EHR can spit out, but other financial information is elsewhere, and then there's other information in a third system because we defined EHI very broadly and they can't comply with the law if they don't share everything, the implementation of that just seems to have gotten dramatically more difficult and costly.
Thanks, John. Okay, team, we are at time. Good conversation. We're going to need to coordinate this out and continue the conversation. Thanks ever so much for everything and all your efforts this week. We'll be continuing next week. Lovin?
Yep, that's it. I think everyone should have the schedule of the work group meetings as well as the full task force meetings. So looking forward to the next call. Thank you, everyone. We'll adjourn for today.
All right. Thank you.
Take care. Thank you, everyone.
Bye-bye.